Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It takes 18 hours to fix a Thanksgiving dinner. It takes 12 minutes to eat it. And it is no coincidence that halftime is 12 minutes long. And she was right. We've just commercialized Thanksgiving.
Judith Barter is quoting Irma Bombeck there. Barter is the curator of the recent exhibition Art and Appetite at the Art Institute of Chicago. This episode, she'll talk about how Thanksgiving has been represented in paintings throughout the years. We visit turkey farmer Mandy Napier, and she introduces us to her flock. When will the farm bill start saving taxpayers money? Harvest Public Media says probably not this year. And cranberries in your cocktail with Chef Daniel Orr. News always kicks off the show. Luann Johnson, welcome.
Rules that require more information on meat labels may be on the outs. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack seemed to signal for the first time late last week that the rules are not compliant with the World Trade Organization standards and must be fixed. Country of Origin Labeling Rules, or COOL rules, force retailers and meatpackers to detail where the livestock from which the meat came was born, raised, and slaughtered. Meat producers in Canada and Mexico have challenged the legality of the rules at the WTO, saying the labels unduly burden them by making their stocks less appealing to U.S. meatpackers, which have to separate and label meat not raised in the U.S. The WTO ruled against the U.S. rules in October. The COOL rules were a technical barrier to trade, the ruling found, and it said they discriminate against meat imports. Mexico and Canada have threatened trade sanctions on U.S. products in retaliation. The U.S. could still appeal the WTO's decision, and U.S. negotiators could still come to an agreement around the rules with Mexico and Canada. Alternatively, Congress could change the rules. Congress could, Vilsack said, quote, give us different directions that would allow us to comport with the WTO ruling to prevent whatever potential retaliation may occur, unquote. Labeling the origin of meat products has consistently polled well among consumers. McDonald's made a statement this week rejecting the Simplot genetically modified potato for its fries. McDonald's is currently the largest buyer of potatoes in the country, and Simplot is its main supplier. Simplot has engineered a potato named the Innate that can resist bruising and browning and stays fresh longer. According to a company statement, quote, McDonald's USA does not source GMO potatoes, nor do we have current plans to change our sourcing practices, unquote. At first glance, McDonald's statement seems to take a stand against GMO potatoes. Upon further investigation, however, the fast food giant is merely stating the obvious. The company cannot currently source GMO potatoes because none are currently on the market. Although they have passed the USDA, Simplot's potatoes are still pending FDA approval. McDonald's also wouldn't likely be changing its sourcing. The company must first test the potato in its markets, and Simplot's potato has yet to be tested on consumers. Additionally, McDonald's sources 3.4 billion pounds of potatoes every year. Simplot's projected harvest of Innate couldn't possibly meet demand immediately. And who's planning on turkey for Thanksgiving? Let's talk about price. How much are your celebratory birds going to cost this year? A drought in 2012 caused a drop in grain supplies, which caused a spike in feed prices. That meant more costs for meat producers, who are now passing those costs on to grocery stores and other retailers. A recent report from the USDA estimates frozen turkey costs about 14 cents more per pound wholesale than it did this time last year. But it's uncertain whether the increase in wholesale turkey costs will equate to a higher bill. Corrine Alexander, an associate professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University, says retailers will sell them for less than wholesale price just to get customers in the door to buy other food and in hopes they'll come back after Thanksgiving is over. The National Agricultural Statistics Service also indicates there are a lot fewer turkeys this year. This year's expected turkey stock is 235 million turkeys, which is the smallest turkey production since 1986, when U.S. farmers produced only 207 million turkeys. I think I'll stick to my no-turkey diet and say yes to vegetarian sausage stuffing, cooked outside the bird, of course. These stories are posted on our website, eartheats.org. And speaking of Thanksgiving, we're taking some vacation time next week, so no news in the show.
But our Twitter feed will be nice and active, talking about foodstuffs. Find us at Earth Eats. Luann Johnson, enjoy your time off.
Thanks, Annie.
Luann is having a vegetarian Thanksgiving. I'm definitely going for some turkey. Come with me as I visit a local farmer who raises turkeys for Thanksgiving. This is Mandy Napier.
And they're a whole lot of fun, but you have to be very open to a lot of possibilities of things that can go right or things that can go wrong.
She says her turkeys are a lot like goats, very curious and mischievous, but not too smart. She ordered these birds back in January. They arrived 6 months later in a couple boxes. They were a day old. Here's how the rest of their lives have been.
Okay, so the turkeys spend their first 8 weeks in the brooder, which is just a poultry nursery, until they're feathered out enough and big enough that they can withstand a rainy day such as this.
Feathered out just means literally feathers. More feathers on their back.
They have feathers, yes. They're just kind of little fluff balls when they first arrive. So we take them out of the brooder at 8 weeks. They literally have started down here in this pasture and literally have worked, by the time we will have processed them, they'll cover about 12 acres. For example, on Monday, we fenced in a 2-acre paddock, and that'll last them, when they get this big, about a week, week and a half, and that's it. Of course, they can stay on that amount of land much longer when they're smaller and their foraging demands are much less.
We're approaching the big, oh my gosh, there are millions of them.
Yes.
Can you give me a head count?
About 900. Hello, hello, hello!
That was so awesome. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, and they're running toward us. Do they think we're going to feed them?
No, they're very curious by nature. They want to know what's going on. They want to know who you are. They're flock creatures too. So
I have to tell you, I'm not afraid of birds, but seeing them all
it's
like
a little
stalked,
intimidating.
It's a lot intimidating.
Yes.
It's
Thanks to Mandy Napier for that tour. See photos of her beautiful shacked farm at eartheats.org. The farm bill enacted earlier this year was supposed to save taxpayers money, in part by reducing subsidy payments to farmers. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, those savings aren't looking as robust as many hoped.
Farmer Robert Lynch of Gilmore City, Iowa, has had a tough year.
It's not a good season for us. I thought we should have better than that according to everybody's forecast, but this is what we got. So it'll be crop insurance, basically.
Lynch's crops didn't produce as well as many other Corn Belt farms, and amid predictions of record harvests, prices fell. But he says his lower-than-average yields won't be too hard on his bottom line, even with the low prices.
We're going to get whatever we were insured or level at, 80 or 85% crop insurance. We're going to have that level, and that's what we're going to be insured for this coming year.
Lynch has crop insurance. It's not so different from your car or homeowner's insurance. You pay a premium, and then if something bad happens, the insurance company gives you money, up to the amount you're insured for. Lynch's private insurance company will adjust and pay his claim. But here's where it's different. Taxpayers subsidize crop insurance.
I'm not aware of any other program that works quite this way.
That's Pat Westhoff, director of the Food and Agriculture Policy Research Institute at the University of Missouri.
The premiums are set so that they just cover the expected losses, and then they're subsidized by the government as well, so that the farmer's only paying a fraction of the overall cost of those premiums.
Higher premiums and higher payouts in bad years cost taxpayers more. If prices are lower and premiums are lower, we're not out as much. But farmers get more help from taxpayers than just subsidized crop insurance. The Farm Bill provides a federal farm safety net. Westhoff says there's one major way its programs differ from insurance.
Farmers do not have to pay premiums to get benefits of those programs.
They just sign up. The current Farm Bill cut out payments to farmers just for owning farmland. The number crunchers at the Congressional Budget Office predicted that changes like this would save taxpayers more than $6 billion over 5 years. But the new farm safety net is still pricey and varies with crop and market conditions. There are two programs. One is tied to price alone, called PLC. The other, known as ARC, considers price and yield.
For the 2014 crop year, we're definitely going to be making larger ARC and or PLC payments than we had earlier anticipated. That's almost certainly going to be the case.
Farmers are still deciding which one they want, so we don't yet know this year's price tag. But with low prices for many of the nation's biggest crops, including corn and soybeans, many worry a hefty round of payments looms. That could curb those projected savings.
What is far less certain is what happens in subsequent years.
For now, farmers are wrapping up the corn and soybean harvest. Semis and tractors pulling grain wagons unload corn at the Heartland Co-op in Alleman, Iowa. Location manager Larry Mitchell says it's been a good year for growing corn and soybeans, even a bit better than he expected. But he says most farmers aren't selling their corn today.
Probably most of it this year, with the prices the way they are storing it right now and then going to wait and see what happens.
Hoping they can get a better price later. And if they do, the public may yet see those promised farm bill savings. But even if this year's a drain on taxpayers, as farmers well know, there's always next year. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporter collective in the Midwest. They produce stories about food and agriculture. Find more of their great work at harvestpublicmedia.org. Judith Barter is the Field McCormick Chair and Curator of American Art at the Art Institute of Chicago. Earlier this year, she curated the exhibition Art and Appetite, American Painting, Culture, and Cuisine at the Art Institute. Barter was on the Indiana University campus, and she spent time with WFIU's Yael Cassander looking through the catalog for the exhibition, full of paintings of food.
And since we are coming up on Thanksgiving, I thought it was very appropriate that you do have so many plucked chickens and turkeys in this book, and also paintings about Thanksgiving itself. It's a far cry from Harnett's chicken hanging there on the door to Alice Neal's painting of a chicken in a kitchen sink that she sort of unceremoniously dumped there to thaw, I imagine. Using these pictures of chickens and various fowl as a launching pad, I'd like to talk about the history of Thanksgiving as codified by some of these American paintings.
Well, Thanksgiving is kind of a late holiday in a way. It wasn't formally made an American holiday until Abraham Lincoln made it a holiday after the Battle of Gettysburg. So
that would come as a surprise, I think, to a lot of people because they think it started way back there in the 17th
century.
With
the Pilgrims, yeah, no. The Pilgrims had Thanksgivings, plural, days of Thanksgivings that did not look anything like how we celebrate Thanksgiving. They fasted, for one thing, and spent the day in church and then came home and had a little something to eat. And the first Thanksgiving, as we all learned in school, was sort of based on festivities when the Indians came to Plymouth with some deer, 20 deer or something, and the colonists there put together vegetables and other things, and they all sat down and had a meal together. And that's referenced in an 18th century book. So Thanksgiving is sort of a new idea, and it was sort of based on the fall harvest in New England, where they usually did have something called Forefathers' Day, not Thanksgiving, which was to celebrate the history of New England. And it was usually in October, and the bringing in of the crops. And then it became increasingly commercial. And by 1920, it was about football. And Irma Bombeck famously said that it takes 18 hours to fix a Thanksgiving dinner. It takes 12 minutes to eat it. And it is no coincidence that halftime is 12 minutes long. And she was right. We've just commercialized Thanksgiving. Not as badly as Christmas, but almost the same way. And I think Alice Neal's painting of the capon thawing in the kitchen sink is really a great picture. First of all, she's thumbing her nose at pop art,
where the surfaces are very slick and everything's perfect. This is a juicy picture with lots of impasto and paint, and it's visceral. And there's this dead bird in the sink. And everybody knows it. Any woman knows, anyway, that that is exactly how Thanksgiving starts, with that bird draining in the sink.
This is an unpicturesque, unromanticized vision of Thanksgiving from the woman's perspective. Although it does make a really pretty great painting, and the design and the composition is fantastic, it is not Norman Rockwell.
No, it is not. It's sort of like, okay, here's this dead thing. What am I going to do with it?
And Alice Neal was quite an outrageous character from
what
I understand.
She was.
Well, did you manage then to, in fact, have the Norman Rockwell painting for this exhibition?
Oh, yes. Freedom from Want.
Can you talk about that one, Judy?
Yes. Norman Rockwell did a series of four paintings based on American freedoms in 1941. And it was based basically on an address by FDR, who was talking about world events and the unique place of Americans. And freedom from want was one of those, in other words, having enough to eat, never having to go hungry. And so Rockwell used this as a Thanksgiving scene. And it's sort of fascinating because there's Grandma and Grandpa, and the whole family is gathered around, and Grandma's bringing in this beautifully browned, you know, cook's kitchen type of of turkey to sit on the table. And yet the weird thing about the picture is all the rest of the table is sort of white with nothing on it to eat. There are some grapes or some nuts. I think there's a dish of celery.
Jell-O
salt
molds.
And pepper. Jell-O molds. Jell-O molds were very important in the 40s and 50s.
I think a wonderful contrast is provided by this Norman Rockwell painting, Freedom from Want, with a painting that was just about contemporaneous with it, and that is your famous painting at the Art Institute, Hopper's Nighthawks.
Yes.
We're seeing a whole different way of interacting around eating and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that painting?
Well, of course, Hopper is showing almost a post-depression or end-of-depression sort of topic. Diners became very popular, as were automats, as cheap places to get food after the Depression. But Hopper's also showing us an urban scene, whereas Rockwell is showing us a more of a domestic scene. Hopper's showing us a diner that operates all night long, and the Nighthawks are the people that hang out late at night, and they're in there having their coffee. And Hopper, a lot of people see loneliness in Hopper. I do not. I see aloneness in Hopper. And I think those are two very different ideas. And so I think Hopper's pictures are more about feeling solitude within a social arena. I find them very poetic in that sense.
Judith Barter, talking about the exhibition she curated for the Art Institute of Chicago. Her appearance in Bloomington was part of Themester 2014, Eat, Drink, Think. More from Yael Cassander's conversation with Barter coming up in the second half of the show.
Well, Americans have always loved to drink, and they have always been equally guilty about it.
She'll give us some historical perspective on the temperance movement. For a little balance, we've got an interactive holiday cocktail recipe that's perfect for entertaining. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
All right, we're going to shake things up today on Earth Eats.
That's Chef Daniel Orr, and I'm Annie Corrigan.
We're going to make one of our shake-up drinks, which we do in ball jars here at Farm Bloomington. They're great for a party because you can measure everything out ahead in ball jars, and then you just add the ice and shake them up and serve them to your guests. So you can pre-portion everything. It's a real simple way to entertain. I'm going to do kind of a fall-winter shake-up today. I've got some fresh cranberries that I've chopped in the food processor. Then I've got the one piece of orange peel, orange zest, that you can take off with a vegetable peeler. Drop that in there. Then I've got some fresh basil out of my garden. Crunch that up a little bit, bring out those essential oils. So to this we're going to add some of our local applejack because it's going to be kind of a cranberry apple martini. Then we've got some really nice Creole shrub rum. So that's a orange rum, but you could use Grand Marnier or Triple Sec. And I'm going to actually put a little slice of lime inside. And then we're going to top it off with apple cider. And then when your guests get here, fill it up with ice until it's about 3/4 of the way full. Then you put the lid on. You give it a good shake.
Like your own personal shaker.
Yeah. And then we're going to just put a little fizz on it with some club soda. Give it a stir. And you've got a wonderful shake-up. Cheers, everybody. Enjoy.
Bill Best can trace certain seeds back several generations in his family. He once found some bean seeds in his mother's freezer that were 35 years old, stored in an airtight container. Sure enough, they germinated, no problem. He comes from a long line of seed savers, and he wishes more gardeners would take up the practice.
Ideally, there would be millions of gardeners saving their own seeds.
He wrote a book called Saving Seeds, Preserving Taste. His specialty is bean seeds. He says beans mutate fairly regularly, which might be why we have so many different varieties of them. Here's 1 minute with gardener and author Bill Best.
In the southern Appalachians, which I really specialize in, mutations would appear in the garden periodically, and they would be called sports. That's the colloquial term for a mutant plant. The matriarch of the family would save those seeds, grow them the next summer, and if they bred true, there would be plenty of them to try out in the kitchen. And then if they were an excellent seed stock, then they would be kept and become a part of that family's lore, and then shared within the extended family and then within the community. And then beans like that often go region-wide. I've got one myself that I call the non-tough half runner that is far and away our best-selling bean. It's my own bean, which is exceptionally tender. People everywhere buy.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Appreciate the time.
You're very welcome.
All right. Have a good one.
Thank you.
More on how you can start saving seeds from your garden at eartheats.org. Back with Judith Barter of the Art Institute of Chicago. In an exhibition, Art and Appetite, alcohol and the lack thereof is front and center in several works. Barter talks about how American artists have depicted alcohol in their works, starting with the temperance movement. She's speaking here with WFIU's Yael Cassander.
It started in this country as early as the 1820s and 30s because we were a nation of drinkers. People didn't drink water. They had hard cider for breakfast. If you were a laborer, you had your 11s around 11 o'clock, which was a big old shot of whiskey or rum. And that was accepted as a benefit of employment. If you were an employer and you didn't provide your labor force with this, you were in trouble. Again, at 4 o'clock, they had drams and other shots of spirits. And there are accounts in the 18th century of town hall meetings where you know, 100 people showed up and put away 175 hot toddies, which was rum with a poker heating it, big bowls of punch, which was every form of alcohol mixed together. And thank God they didn't drive then, because they must have really staggered or crawled home. It's interesting, too, that there were various levels of temperance. The word teetotaler is an interesting one. A lot of people think that means, oh, well, they drank tea instead of booze. When you took the temperance pledge, there were two kinds of pledges you could take. You had to sign up in a book. And if you just signed the pledge, it meant you were abstaining from spirits. You could drink wine or hard cider or beer, but no hard liquor. If you put tea next to your name, it meant total abstinence, and that meant you drank no alcohol of any kind.
So we see, though, in the various paintings, alcohol represented in a restrained way, in a quasi-religious way, and all kinds of other ways that seem to manifest this anxiety about intoxication and also about sensual pleasure.
True. The temperance movement was pretty hardcore, and what it was based on was a certain amount of reality that men got paid on Fridays, and a large portion of the population drank their wages on the way home. And there are so many cartoons, and we included a lot in the book, of women and children destitute in the street while dad's drinking at the bar in the saloon and that kind of thing. And even the artist George Caleb Bingham shows people going to vote, election scenes where they the voters are all being bribed with alcohol. They're all drunk out of their minds, and they've sold their vote for a quart of moonshine. So drinking was an issue. There's no question. And the temperance movement was really a hot issue, as I said, in the 1860s and 1870s, which is when Welch's Grape Juice was founded by a minister and his son, because there was this controversy over, well, can we drink wine at communion? I mean, it's alcohol. And the churches got divided on this. And so he came up with a non-alcoholic grape juice beverage, which the Methodists still serve today.
WFIU's Yael Cassander speaking with Judith Barter, Field McCormick Chair and Curator of American Art at the Art Institute of Chicago. Hear the entire conversation at wfiu.org/profiles. Our hardworking Earth Eats crew includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. A special shout out to Yael Cassander for her help this week. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. If we don't hear from you before then, have a great holiday. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.